Welcome to 1001 Albums. Today we're going to be discussing Architecture and Morality by Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark with Andy McCluskey from OMD. Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning. Much appreciated.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it's been, I watched an interview that I think you did fairly recently with a chap who was, I think, supposed to be from Mexican radio, but he was actually from Stratford-upon-Avon or something, which kind of confused me a little
bit. Yes, that was quite strange, yes.
But so talking to him, he was sort of, you were sort of saying about being in lockdown. It's obviously been a bit tricky for everyone, but it's been interesting. It's been sort of a real leveler, whether you're sort of an international pop star or someone else. Everyone's kind of in a similar boat, aren't they? Stuck at home. It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, in that respect, it is. To be honest, I'm lucky. I quite enjoyed the enforced slowdown because I've been incredibly busy for most of the 6 or 7 months beforehand. And then, you know, the enforced time and a bit of boredom actually made me rediscover the kind of creative power of boredom, which was great. And I think that there will now be a new OMD album in 22, which we hadn't anticipated. The downside really is not so much for us, because we are in a decent position financially. We're okay. We can sustain ourselves through this. But the support staff, the crew and the technical people in the music industry, I think, are really going to struggle. I think there's going to be some serious damage done to rental companies and PA crew and backline crew. And this is the biggest worry, I think, for me.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. Having done this podcast, and also I do the my main sort of thing I do is the Oasis podcast, and so what I do on that is talk to lots of people who have been on the outskirts of the Oasis world, and so it is a lot of people, whether they're engineers or just touring musicians and things like that. And yeah, having spoken to a lot of those guys, yeah, it's very, very hard. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. But I one of the things I was saying to someone the other day actually is I really hope that coming from this, I mean, we've had it so easy for so long with just accepting that music is a free commodity that everyone can just have. And so I wonder if coming out of this, actually people will appreciate, oh no, there are actual people in this industry that deserve to be supported. And so maybe we should start actually paying for things again. I don't know.
It would be nice if that model was corrected, but I can't see it. I mean, I think that the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems that the music industry had, aside from Corona and lockdown, was that, as you say, there's been this, since it's gone digital, we went to downloads and then we've gone to streaming. People just don't perceive there's a value to recorded music, you know, when it's just a file and you don't even have to own it now, and you can have Spotify with the adverts for no money at all. There's no perceived value to a recorded piece of music, and I think that's, I mean, and the royalties that are paid by streaming companies, I'm afraid, are just short of legalized piracy, to be honest. I think they're shocking. So, you know, that's an issue for people who owned their own intellectual property. I mean, for years, we've had to survive on the songs that we wrote. And recently, the touring income has become more value than the actual songs that we wrote that we've relied on for 40 years. So again, this goes back to why I'm so concerned about the touring issue, you know, being put on hold for an entire year. It's going to be very hard to pick up the pieces again.
Yeah, and it will remain to be seen what gigs will look like, whether it's 21, 22 and going forward, whether it will go back to similar.
You can't realistically do gigs with everybody standing 2 meters apart. It's just no vibe. It's just not worth it, you know. But
no, especially at the lower level as well. That's really important, you know, because the UK entertainment industry and the music industry is such a massive industry. You know, I was reading the other day, it's like bigger than agriculture, you know, so this needs to be cultivated, and we need to have these sweaty little clubs like Eric's, like you guys got your kind of, you really cut your teeth in. They need to have the Eric's and the Caverns and these places where people can kind of, you know, to develop those scenes and develop the next OMD or the next whoever it's going to be.
Yes, if there's nothing at the grassroots, then there's no conveyor belt to take people into the future.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, today we're going to be talking primarily about the album Architecture and Morality. This is the 1001 Albums podcast. So what I've normally been doing is going through the list that was in this book, Robert Dimmery's book, 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die. And Architecture and Morality is the only OMD album in there, which I thought was interesting. So first off, I mean, is that, were you aware of that book? And generally, do you kind of keep an eye on top 100 polls and top 1000s and, you know, all that sort of thing? Does that interest you, or are you not too bothered?
I'm aware of the book. I'm not too bothered about lists and polls because, quite frankly, one of the things that has always been a thing for us is that we were never the most high-profile band. We have a loyal following who really love and respect what we do, which is wonderful. We're blessed. But you know, people, even to this day, when, you know, we've been reformed now for 13 years and we're playing massive festivals and huge crowds, you still get people who, you know, haven't seen us and go, oh my God, I had no idea how good you were live, and I had no idea how many hits that I knew. And you just go, yeah, I know, we hear it all the time. We're constantly trying to convert people, but it's a long, slow process. So, you know, we just accept it. When people think of the 80s, they usually think of the kind of high profile dressed up bands like Duran Duran and Spandau and Culture Club. You know, we were busy being sort of dour northern working class boys who just wanted to people to listen to the music and not think that we looked like dressed up pop stars.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other interesting one I found was that, because I'm a 90s kid, I was born 1980, so I really got into music sort of through the Britpop scene, and so I kind of did the look back at what Oasis told me to listen to. So it was the white indie guitar bands from kind of, you know, the Beatles onwards, and OMD doesn't really sit in that kind of canon where you go from you know, you go from the Beatles and the Stones and the Who, and then you have like punk. They go with the Jam and the Clash and all the bands with the at the start. But then it kind of jumps to like the Smiths and then the Stone Roses and then the Happy Mondays and then into Britpop. But then going back to OMD, you know, and, I mean, Joy Division come into that equation. And you go to OMD and you think, well, this sounds like Joy Division. You know what I mean? And I think maybe that you suffered from the fact you did have these sort of internet, I mean, suffered, you know, it's not suffered obviously in a financial sense, but in terms of that canon of these are the bands, you know, do you think that it was like the success that you ended up having that kind of then people don't then think of you as a Joy Division or a Smiths maybe?
Yes, I agree to a large extent. I think that it's the perception of the band, for a number of reasons, is not considered to be, you know, terribly cool or of great cultural relevance, unless you start talking to people who are interested in kind of conceptual music and electronic music, and then we get reference, because we started as a hobby. We were the absolute antithesis of a four-piece rock band. You know, there was two of us and a tape recorder. As we used to joke, you know, had Lennon and McCartney started in the late 70s, they would have had a tape recorder too, and there would have been no Harrison and Starr in the Beatles.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, no,
You know, and we were consciously trying to make music that was actually different. But what happened then was, amazingly, what we didn't realize, we'd unconsciously sort of created tunes around our conceptual ideas. What we thought was art also turned out occasionally to be, was going to be the new pop music. ¶¶ And it sounds preposterous when I say it was just a hobby that got out of hand, but it was. You know, I was going to go and do a fine art degree, and Paul was going to be an electrician, and this was just our hobby. And Factory Records, you know, heard we played at the Factory the second gig we ever did, because Eric said, "Oh, you know, we've got this reciprocal arrangement in Manchester. Why don't you pop down there?" And yeah, it was just one door opened, another one opened, another one opened. The next thing you know, songs that we thought were experimental turn out to be catchy hit singles. And yeah, that is held against you quite often. And the fact that we, you know, yeah, we weren't a rock band. And we didn't conform. And obviously it was very strange in the 90s when I don't think we realized at the time that we were entering the kind of postmodern phase of popular culture, and so it was going to start consuming its own history. And so a lot of the bands in the 90s that you mentioned started to reference bands that we were trying to fight against to create something new. And it was a real head scratcher for us to go, hang on, we're now out of fashion, and things from 20 years ago are back in fashion. Are the new fashion? How the hell did that happen?
It's crazy, isn't it?
took a while to adjust to that.
Yeah, but what's really interesting now as well is you listen to modern pop music, like you know, and not just sort of manufactured pop music, but also like heralded as these are the most important artists now. People like Bastille, you know, have got these strong kind of synth hooks, you know, really catchy, strong synth hooks based around these sort of pop songs. And it's similar to like even hip hop, like even like Drake and Kendrick Lamar and people like this. They're going back to the old 808s and that sort of that early hip hop sound that was a real big crossover with British electronic. That is now super cool again, and you won't hear a guitar on the radio. So it's amazing how this stuff shifts around.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, you know, we continue to be in a kind of postmodern era. I mean, studio production now is unbelievable, and everything gets so processed that when a rock band goes out on tour, you know, trying to make them sound like the record, basically, you know, they're all up there playing and half the stuff's on Pro Tools underneath the drummer's, you know, riser or something. It's the way it is now, you know. But I think that also you've just got this, everything is allowable now. You know, you can have bits of anything, and it's how it's perceived. You know, if you've got a guy playing guitar at the front, then people think it's rock, even though when you listen to it, you go, I'm hearing more synths than guitar. You know? So, and as you say, hip hop, you know, I mean, the 808 is still, you know, their choice of, because it's got the light top end and the great big fat sine wave bass drum that, you know, shakes the bass speakers in the car.
No, absolutely. And it's that is the essence of modern pop, like, you know, whether it's Kanye West or, as I say, like Kendrick Lamar and all these people, it is amazing, really. But going back to like 1981, going into record Architecture and Morality, obviously you'd had these two very like critically acclaimed and successful albums, but then Enola Gay becomes this huge international sort of success, and then you have to go in back into sort of the recording studio and you know, and follow up on that. I mean, did you feel a pressure at that stage, or was it more of a, like an excitement of like, ah, the world is like really listening to us, we can really do something exciting now?
Yeah, it was the latter. I mean, we were utterly amazed that things we'd been writing that even our mates thought were crap, because they were into like Genesis and the Eagles and Pink Floyd. Suddenly we were having hits, and so we just thought, wow, we do what the hell we feel like doing, and people buy it. This is fantastic. So, you know, writing a song about the airplane that dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima and it being a massive 5 million selling hit single around the world, you just thought, I can do anything I want. This is great. It's just bonkers. There's no rules that affect me. I can do what I want and people buy it. And so we strode into the third album with massive confidence. And our kind of raison d'etre was to, no matter what had happened before, or how successful or lack of success it had, and it was all been success up to that point, we consciously used to change our sound. You know, we've done that now. We're going to change direction again. Yeah. And so we went from the sort of garage synth pop of the first album to the more dark and broody stuff on the second album. And then the third album, we changed sound. We got Mellotron. We got big military drums and went kind of ambience and choirs. And we did Architecture Morality, which sounded nothing like the first two albums and was even bigger with three top five singles on it.
No, absolutely. And watching the, I watched the documentary that came out around the time of the reunion when you first did the big shows in Germany. It was brilliant. It was really good. And I think if people can dig that out, and it's really worth a watch, because it's really lovely seeing yourself and Paul going back to Eric's and going back to the studio and stuff. And one of the things, and it's got you going back to the original tapes for the first time, and it's lovely to see. Actually, I always thought of OMD as this sort of very structured, you guys, you know, you wore suits, you looked very like you knew what you were doing. And I imagined that like this was all, you know, very, very designed and specific. And you knew exactly what you were doing, how you were doing it. And then when you go back and see this, it's so much of it was trial and error. And so much of it was like, well, if I hold this button down, that makes a good sound. Oh, okay, I now have to press that button. And I just think that was fantastic. That sort of the spirit of invention that comes from just physically having these bits of machinery that you can like mess around with and create these incredible sounds.
You're right. I mean, it was all done, you know, we were making it up as we went along. We had no idea what we were doing. I mean, Paul and I couldn't play our instruments when we started writing together. It was literally, in fact, Paul didn't even have an instrument. He used to cannibalize his auntie's radios for the circuits and just make things that made noises. And then, yeah, you know, we got a cheap Fox Jaguar organ, an even cheaper Selmer Pianotron that is the plinky plonky melody in electricity. And then we played our first six gigs without owning a synthesizer. We were a synth band without a synthesizer, which is somewhat counterintuitive. And it was, you know, our first synth we bought from my mother's mail order catalogue that cost $7.76 for 36 weeks out of our dole money. It was, you know, our mate had a studio in the garage and had a four-track tape machine, which we used on stage. And he had a vision hire van, so he drove us around, and so he became the manager. And that was it. It was totally, it was like a little cottage industry, and we were making do with what we had. But it was, you know, the mother of invention. We just we just racked our instruments to the edge of what was possible out of them, and people liked the noise we made.
Absolutely. And like you're saying, like in the modern world, you know, you can literally get GarageBand on your phone and create whatever you want whenever you want, and it's so easy. But actually there isn't, you know, I haven't heard that many kind of really interesting and exciting new voices coming through. I think it's almost too easy. I think you need to kind of strip away that stuff and actually just, you know, get back to, I don't know, like knocking up an old keyboard with circuits from your mum's toaster. Yeah. Or whatever you said.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is, James, that you've got you know, you have now got programs and computers and plugins that, you know, very quickly you can make something that passes for music, that passes for a song. But actually, because it's all made of pre-programmed stuff, it's just a sort of shell, it's a veneer of a song. You actually haven't put any personality or feeling or thought into it. And I think that's the problem. I mean, you know, way back in the old days, you know, people used to go, oh, well, you know, the synthesizer, it writes the song for you, doesn't it? And I've been on TV going, I fucking wish it had a button that had hit sync. I'd be pressing it all day long, you know. But it doesn't. We have to write the notes and record them, you know.
No, absolutely. Like, just going into the album itself, I was, because hands up, I'll have to be honest with you, I've never actually sat down and listened to an OMD album from start to finish until I sort of started this project. And I was aware of you guys. I you know, loved Enola Gay, and even in the 90s, the like Milky Way and Sailing on the Seven Seas, these were like big songs that were like great radio songs and stuff. And it's almost, you know, but it was really interesting for me to actually dig into this album And then, you know, and you go to the new Stone Age with an idea of what OMD is. And the first sort of thing you really hear that jumps out is like this discordant electric guitar. And you think, wait, hold on a minute. Is this an OMD? Have I pressed the right thing? And you've got this discordant electric guitar comes in. And then you've got this despair, wail of despair in the chorus. Oh my God, what have I done this time? Which feels strangely prescient right now in 2020, actually. And then you've got these keyboards going, but they're kind of all breaking down and they're off key. And to me, it sounds like, and apologies if this is kind of obvious or completely wrong, it feels like society based around technology breaking down. And the new Stone Age is going to be what we come out of this society. And the breaking down of the keyboards in that song, it just feels like, you know, the machines have taken over and they're crumbling. Or, you know what I mean? Is that, am I completely off the mark, or is that, what do you think?
I think it's a very interesting kind of analogy, and I think you've taken something very powerful from the song. You know, it's an interesting thing, is if you try to imbue a song with some real feeling and passion and power, what people get out of it is not always what you put into it. Mm. However, as long as they get something, it's good. Now, the new Stone Age, there are elements of it which, yeah, I think you're right. I've always been a history buff. Mm. I've always liked the more, the less civilized parts of history, you know, sort of early history and pre-Roman and pre-Norman and, you know, the Dark Ages and Stone Age. So there was always going to be that element of that in. And one of the things, you see, we're not that smart. We're not that kind of tidy and tight. Mm. Our sound is the contrast and the juxtaposition of the fragile human elements against the machinery. And it's that kind of tension, that space of tension in the middle, which is where we operate. And the new Stone Age, I think, and again, it's partly... partly complete chance, but actually what you hear as society breaking down is actually McCluskey being in such haste to try this new idea he had that I recorded over a track that I thought wasn't working because I wanted the bass drum that was already there. And so at the end of me thrashing the guitar and writing a new song, bit by bit, as I dropped out of record, this other song emerges from the wreckage of New Stone Age. So it is this sort of like post-apocalyptic landscape coming out of one song into another, and you go, that, what the hell, huh, what? And so it does, it was entirely unconscious, but it was fortuitous that it does create this sort of, you know, one song collapses and there's something left in the residue, you know.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I mean, going on from New Stone Age, then we go into She's Leaving, which, you know, is just so, it's just such a beautiful song. And and I've read that there's definitely a nod to Lennon McCartney here, or specifically McCartney, I suppose, with that song. But I've never really heard you talk about that. So was that a deliberate kind of nod to sort of, okay, you did She's Leaving Home with these sort of ancient instruments in harpsichords. Let's take a similar theme, but now this is the sort of the, you know, the very up-to-date modern version of that.
I mean, there is a nod to Lennon and McCartney, because obviously, you know, you can't unknow the song She's Leaving Home. So when I was writing a song about imagining somebody turning their back on a relationship, or a woman giving up on a man, because, you know, it's just not working and she needs to get out of it. It's not a, you know, it's not the same lyric, but it is somebody leaving and turning their back on something. That's the only there is a reference to it, but that's the only reference. There was no conscious attempt for us to not sound like the Beatles, to make a point of being modern. It was just, you know, fired up a drum machine, started playing bass, and off we went.
Every day.
I mean, I think one of the things that you may have surprised you in listening to this album is, one, it's weird, and yet it was a massive album. And two, is it's quite emotional and melancholy in large parts. You know, for a band that's supposed to be a synth band, we trade in feelings.
No, definitely. That was a surprise. And I think people coming listening to this or maybe going into it for the first time will be taken aback by that. And like like we've said, the Joy Division influence, and the, obviously because you were sort of contemporaries with Joy Division and you know, played with them and things like that, so you can hear that. And that was a real surprise. I mean, then you even sort of a track like Souvenir, which comes up next. You think of Souvenir and you've just got this sort of this beautiful, you know, the beautiful melody line, and then Paul's voice is so fragile and gorgeous in it. But then that's got dark moments. That's got sort of, you know, a moment where it just drops down to these sort of discordant chords. You think, wait, whoa, where's this going? You know, it's so even in those moments of like pop majesty, you're never 100% in the sunshine. There's always a quick step back into the cupboard, isn't there? I think
we were quite confident in not following the rules. I mean, to be honest, we didn't know the rules because we were self-taught. I mean, people would look at me playing the bass and they go, "Your technique is appalling." I'm like, "Yeah," and I played on Enola Gay and it sold 5 million, so fuck off. you know, it's Enola Gay is only four notes all the way through, and they're all the same. But yeah, I mean, Souvenir, it has a beautiful dreamlike quality. But you know, the bass drum isn't a bass drum; it's a tuned down rotor tom because we wanted something that was sort of a bit rounder. It's made out of these looped choirs. Mm. It's just we had hits by writing things that didn't actually conform. You grew up listening to them on the radio, and to you, it's just like, oh yeah, that's that hit by OMD. Mm. You know, that they must have sat down and went, right, how do we write a hit single? We just sat down and went, right, what the hell do we want to do next? Mm. So let's see what else we can fuck around with. And I mean, Souvenir, you know, it's the middle eight is just a tom going and two choir chords going nothing else, no vocals, no melody, no lead guitar solo. It's just like, that sounds nice, we'll leave that. we wrote our own rules.
And watching that doc from 2007, I think at the time you were talking about the fact that when Souvenir first came out, it wasn't like your particular favourite and you were quite uncomfortable with it as a song, but then you've sort of grown to appreciate it. And now obviously it's like 13 years on from having reformed and having done so many more concerts and played it live, and also I heard sung it live as well when Paul's voice went.
I've sung it live three times now.
Three times, wow. What's your view on it now, having had that extra few years?
I remain convinced that it's an absolutely beautiful song, but yeah, at the time, Paul and I, you know, everything on the first album was written by both of us because we'd written the songs together in his mother's back room. And we started to get a studio. Sometimes I would be there longer than him, or I'd have an idea on my own. And this is when we started to write song. There would be songs by one of us and not the other. And it is a bit weird, you know. I mean, Enola Gay was difficult for him to get his head around, basically because it was an adopted child. He wasn't involved in the birth process, you know. And so similarly, Souvenir, I mean, I tried my hardest to fuck that song up. I tried changing the drums. I tried trying to put some punky Jean-Jacques Bonnell bass on it because I thought it was far too syrupy. Yeah. But once it was released, I just sort of thought, actually, stop fighting against this. Just roll over and let it tickle your tummy. It's gorgeous. You know?
No, it is great. It is. It is a beautiful song. Then on the album, then we come to a really interesting piece, an almost 8-minute soundscape, Sealand. And this is, I think, where you can hear the Joy Division influence. And this is where I think you can then sort of see where you then go on the next album. And for me, this, I know you've talked before about the fact that architecture and morality, like you were saying earlier, that's it's almost like it's the two elements. You've got the electronic and then you've got the heart. And I really think this comes across in this song particularly, because you're describing this almost industrial scene, but and it's primarily electronic instruments doing it, but it doesn't sound like, you know, like Kraftwerk doing the singing about a road or something. You know, this does feel like an organic piece, and I think it's a really great piece, and it's something that might surprise a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, the previous album, we'd written a song called Stanlow about the oil refinery near us, and it was quite ambient. It started with this just suspended chord and machine noises. So we'd allowed ourselves to go into a more ambient place. I need to ask you a question, actually. Mm. How do you know the music of the band Neu? Do you know Neu?
A bit, yeah. Yeah, the
from Dusseldorf.
Yeah, the krautrock scene. Yeah,
some of their more melancholy moments, we were inspired by them as much as Kraftwerk, actually. In fact, we often say that we are the kind of bastard love child of Kraftwerk and Neu. It's the emotion and the electronics, and I think you know, letting the cat out of the bag, I mean, Neu 75 has a song on it called Sealand. And it's very melancholy and quiet and slow. And although we didn't copy it, you know, knowing that song gave us an opportunity to allow ourselves to be completely stripped and ambient. I mean, I know people, you know, I'm not a dope smoker, but I know dope smokers who just say, I just have that track on repeat, mate. I'm off the box for hours. It's great.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I can imagine that would take you to a certain place. Yeah, definitely. Then in the album, then we come to the two Joan of Arc songs, which are both brilliant, both very different, but both great. The question I had is, was there ever a consideration to make this a Joan of Arc concept record? Because you've got two great Joan of Arc songs. You've got a song called She's Leaving, which could be about Joan of Arc going off to war. You've got a song about, you've got a song like Souvenir, which has got that wistfulness. It could be a Joan. You could have just gone, I'll tell you what, scrap all the lyrics. Let's just make it a Joan of Arc concept record.
Do you know what? If I hadn't written good songs about Joan, it could have ended up being so, because the reason why there are two is because that the waltz version of Joan of Arc, the Maid of Orleans, was written first, and I decided to bin it because I didn't think it was working, but I so wanted a song about Joan of Arc, I wrote the next one. I went, oh, that doesn't work, I'm going to write another one. And then actually when we were packing up to go down to the manor to do the final recording, Paul and Malcolm basically said, yeah, well, what happened to that, you know, that boom cha cha waltzy version? I said, I've binned it, it doesn't work. I said, no, that was good, we should try that when we get to the studio. And I remember Malcolm said, just let me play drums on it, it'll be fine. And so that's why we had two. But no, I don't think we ever would have considered a complete Joan of Arc concept album. You know, I'm not Rick Wakeman. I'm not going to have a concept. I think actually having a trying to shoehorn something into a concept album, I think is quite difficult. I think you either end up with spurious connections or with things that don't work because you're trying to go, oh God, we've got to have the bit where she's, you know, she's burnt at the stake, but I don't quite know how to express that musically. Fuck, what am I going to do, you know?
Fire. So
well, there you go, yeah. There was never going to be a concept album. But the one thing I did try to do, which was a fabulous concept, was to, I mean, again, going back to this, you know, to break the rules.
Yeah.
I wanted both songs to be called Joan of Arc and be released as consecutive singles. And the record company went, you can't do that. I said, no, that's really great. That will be absolutely fuck with people's heads. And they said, yeah, they'll think they've already bought it, so they're not going to buy it again. And we had this standoff. I'm like, no, this is great fun. We're going to mess with people's heads. We're going to have two songs that are different, but under the same name consecutively. This is going to be brilliant. And no. So I eventually conceded that argument, but what's quite funny is that most people, when they say, oh, I like Joan of Arc, they actually mean Maid of Orleans.
Right.
Because that was the bigger international hit. Because, the boom-cha-cha one.
Yeah.
And again, there was nothing better than standing on the top of the pop stage and there might have been Cliff or Elton or Lena Zavaroni or somebody, God knows, you know, on before us, knowing that we're about to start with a song that has an intro of 40 seconds of distortion.
And then it's
a waltz with what sounds like a bagpipe.
I was going to say it's 40, I timed it. It's about 45 seconds before the bass comes in. And when I actually went back and watched the Top of the Pops performance of it, and you do think, come on, something's got to kick in. You can imagine sort of, you know, people in the 80s, like eating their chips in front of the Top of the Pops on a Thursday night going like, are they going to get on and actually play something here? Yeah, very bold move for what is a great pop song.
It wasn't thought to be a single. I mean, we wrote it with the waltz drum machine and then added Malcolm's drums over the top. And then we just thought, it's only 2.5 minutes long. It's too short. Okay, well, hang on. Why don't we set it up with some weirdness at the front that sort of, it will emerge out of this kind of swirling atmospheric noise. So that's what we did. We just went, and because we're not a guitar band, we didn't actually have a distortion pedal. So in order to get the distortion, we had to put everything overloaded through the old Helios valve desk and just ram the volumes up and crank the tones up till the desk distorted because we didn't have a fuzz pedal to actually make any distorted sounds.
That is brilliant.
I know it was great fun. You know, we were all between the ages of 20 and 22 standing there going, have some of this noise. This ain't Elton John.
You old farts. This is the future.
But this is it. You know, you grew up thinking we just made, you know, cleverly constructed hit singles. We were actually trying to mess with people.
Yeah, no.
By absolutely. Having hit singles that didn't fit any kind of pattern, you know?
Yeah, no, it's been such an interesting part of this journey, coming to you guys and the saying and having dug into the other albums as well. It's been a real joy, actually. It's been a real pleasure. The other thing, I mean, the first Joan of Arc song, it's got the like Should Have Known Better, which is a great hook. I mean, once again, there's a Beatles song called Should Have Known Better.
Known better with a girl like you.
Yeah. I didn't realize that this could be. Yeah. So it's not similar, but I don't know. It just felt like maybe another little nod, and I was thinking that with that, and then the first point we made, because there's Mellotron as well, and Mellotron was most famously used on the Beatles records, you know, particularly Strawberry Fields. So I didn't know whether there was a sort of a Lennon McCartney vibe of thinking like, okay, well, you know, we are Liverpool. Let's embrace that a little bit now. We're sort of onto this sort of main stage, or am I bringing that to you with my like Beatles fandom head?
Yes, you are. Little Catholic girl who's fallen in love. The face on a page, a gift from above. She should have known better than to give her heart. She should have known better than to ever bond without me. Now, you got to understand that, you know, the Beatles split up when we were like 10.
Yeah.
So that when we were teenagers, particularly, you know, in the days before postmodern musical concept, when everything was acceptable and could be remixed and recombined, there was a definite sense of timeline. You know, this is new, therefore that is old. Mm. And so by the time I was 15, 16, the Beatles had been split up for 5 years, and I was like, God, that's ancient, that's old hat, that's from, you know. And we found our inspiration from Dusseldorf, not from Liverpool.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted to sound anything but the Beatles. I mean, obviously you come out the other end and you look back and you've mellowed a bit and you go, wow, you know, how did they write so many incredible songs in such a short period of time? But at the time, you know, they were just one of the many, you know, hit acts from the previous generations that we were trying to sound unlike.
Fair enough. No, that makes a lot of sense. We then come on to the title track, Architecture and Morality. And this to me sounds like a broadcast from another planet. This to me just feels like we are tuning in to another planet, to an alien life form. I don't know whether it's because the synth lines on it feels a bit sort of War of the Worlds, or it feels a bit Close Encounters, you know, but that's I don't know what your take on it is, but that is, to me, I'm in tune with we're picking up messages from another planet here.
I get that. I mean, we allowed ourselves the luxury of saying, right, we're going to create the title track when we go to the Manor Studios, and we're just going to put a collage together. We had no idea what we were going to do. We got a load of Gregorian chant records, which we recorded and then turned the tapes over. So backwards Gregorian chant was part of the bed track. I had grown up listening to shortwave radio. Now, the next album after Architecture Morality, Dazzle Ships, is the one that has most of the shortwave radio references to the Cold War. But I was acutely aware that every radio station has its call sign that's distinctive, and it sounds like kind of like an ice cream van. So we created that da 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 as like a radio call sign, but it does have this sort of like, you know, is it a spaceship landing? Is it a faraway planet? Is it a radio station from the, you know, the other side of the Iron Curtain? And so, you know, there are all sorts of elements in there where it was just completely free-flowing. We were just like, yeah, let's do this now. How about that? Let's try that. You know, let's just put the synth on random and go. But the one thing is, we love experimenting, but we don't want to leave an experiment as an experiment for its own sake and go, there you go. That was different, wasn't it? You hated it. We always believed in musicality.
Yeah.
And so Architecture Morality, the title track, is utterly bonkers. It's a collage of all sorts of different sounds, but it's very listenable. You don't come out the other end going, God, my fillings are falling out and I'll never listen to that again. It is musical. Thank you.
The next track is Georgia, and I thought this was the one thing that really struck me at this is I don't know if you've really followed the sort of the modern kind of musical genre like chiptune or like digitune or Nintendo Core or all these kind of bands like Anamanaguchi that take that sort of 8-bit kind of computer game music that you would play on like an Amstrad game in the 80s, and that is now such a big genre. And something like Georgia has got that like it feels like that. It feels like the, you know, obviously people, what they were referencing was, you know, these video games, but yeah, it really feels like a precursor to this whole crazy huge scene that a lot of people don't even know about, but it's massive.
You know what? Yeah, you're absolutely right. Again, you know, we weren't trying to invent a genre that the sort of crunchy 8-bit kiddies toy thing. But yeah, it does actually, when you think about it, but you know, it was just by its very nature, quite simply, it's our drum machine, our cheap drum machine, not the CR78, but they'll just with a straight rock pattern on it. And then it's Paul playing by hand. It sounds like a sequencer, but it's Paul playing our cheap little Korg micro presets and da 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 da. And it's just that cheesy little tune on repeat. But then the song is about Cold War geopolitics, because the Georgia is not Georgia in America, it's Georgia in the old USSR. That's why, you know, we will watch the Morning Star riding over home Georgia, and then it's considering the post-apocalyptic. I mean, dancing in the shadows of the Western world, blindfolds on, like we don't care. It's supposed to be about, you know, here we all are having a jolly time, and quite soon the bomb's going to go off. Because see, my generation confidently expected that somebody was going to press that red button, and we were all going to Armageddon hell. We couldn't believe it when the wall came down in '89. You know, you were a kid, so you didn't really understand. You know, we used to go and play in Berlin, and you'd have to go through the checkpoints, you'd have to weave through the tank traps, they'd time you down the corridor. It was heavy duty, you know. You really thought that somebody would press the button. So that's what that song is about. Actually, it sounds cheesy and poppy, but it's actually about geopolitics, communism, and the end of the world,
which is about as low as you can get. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then the album ends with the beginning of the end. And I don't know if there is a guitar in between, but obviously we had the guitar
That's me playing guitar.
First track. But then we have the guitar back again at the end. But this time there's it's not kind of distorted and out of tune and sort of, you know, creating that juxtaposition. Now it's much more melodic, it's much more in tune. But it's just this what I think is so great about it is that, like, if you listen to an Eric Clapton album or a Jimi Hendrix album or something, Jeff Beck, there's guitar all the way through and you nod your head and yeah, that's good. But it sort of melds in with everything else. Whereas when you guys bring in a guitar, you go like, oh, a guitar. And it really jumps out. And so the guitar line on this is, it sounds great. And it really, it's like the greatest bands, I think, that when they bring in an instrument, you know, and it's like, now we've got this on this track, and it jumps out at you. And I think the guitar on that track is absolutely fantastic. And I mean, the whole track is great, but yeah, it's really the guitar, I think, that makes that, just because it's so different.
Thank you. Right? Yeah, I mean, I can't play guitar. So, you know, I learned to play for a few months when I was 16, then I moved to bass. well, I was 15 actually, then I moved to bass because it was a lot easier. And so, I had a chord and I was plucking it. And because of the way we used to write, you see, a lot of these songs are the way they are because we write onto tape. We wrote onto tape. You know, there was only two of us writing. So we would set a drum machine up and then just start playing something for 4 minutes and then see if we got something that worked. And then we go, okay, well, we need to change now for a middle eight or a chorus or something. So and we'd write, you know, we'd erase something and we'd drop in to record. And literally I played that just, you know, my fingers gripping the strings and hurting like hell, and just played it for 4 minutes. And then when we decided that we wanted to have changes in it, then I played the other chords one at a time because I just have to drop in and go dring.
Yeah.
And then, okay, now unmute. So we wrote these very linear songs because they were written onto tape. So the way we constructed a song was entirely down to the technology we were using. Now you've got computers, you can cut and paste and move things around wherever you want. But in the old days, it was like we weren't going to cut a 2-inch tape. We just erase things or drop into record. So, yeah, it's... Do you know what? We weren't against guitars. There's nothing inherently evil about an electric guitar. It's the cliched twats that play them.
Brilliant. No, I really like that. I really like the way that just comes in. And that's it. And then that's the end of the album. I mean, looking back at it now, all these years on, obviously you've now got all these sort of 40th anniversaries coming through now. I suppose once these things come out, you then have the 10, the 15, the 20. I mean, we've got the 40th anniversary. Looking back at it from the year 2020, I mean, what's your current sort of views on the legacy of this album, looking back?
I'm very proud of it because we did what we wanted to do. And by writing our own rules, we created something that was very successful at the time. Really, we like to think that people got things from our music because we weren't trading in cliches, so we were giving them something more valuable and interesting instead. And not all the songs were, you know, "Oh, I love you" or "You don't love me." You know, let's write a song about an airplane, an oil refinery, about geopolitics in the state of Georgia, you know. So we were on a bit of a mission to try to kind of, you know, educate and inform, as well as have a good time. It sounds preposterously pretentious, doesn't it? But we were. I certainly was, anyway.
See, but I love that. And I'd say I loved watching this this documentary from 2007 and the other interviews I've heard of you. Like, I love the fact that you're so self-aware of this. I mean, I've interviewed quite a lot of people that are not self-aware at all. And if they don't see it as we were pretentious, they're still in that world and they haven't maybe got that ability to step back and look at themselves. So I think it's an absolutely brilliant attitude that you've got. And it just must be great that you know, to have now being able to go out and tour it and well, obviously not right now, but yeah, and have these sort of, you know, and get to see the impact that it's had on these people. And as I say, your fans are some of the most dedicated fans, you know, in the whole of fandom. You know, OMD fans are absolutely the most fervent and passionate, aren't they?
Yeah, and we're really blessed with that. And I hope it's because we have, you know, reached out and given them a lot of stuff that has been something that, you know, we might not have changed the world, but we've given people bits of things that they've adopted in their world that mean a lot to them. And And I think, you know, we've done it accidentally. And that's what makes it even better, you know. And going back to what you said about, you know, being self-deprecating and self-aware, because we didn't want to be pop stars or rock stars, because it was a hobby that got out of hand, we've always had this kind of, like, you know, raised eyebrow kind of, you know. I mean, Paul and I, whenever we used to do Top of the Pops, just before they came to us with the red light and Peter Powell or Jimmy Savile, God help us, we'd go, and now, you know, straight in at number, we'd look at each other and mouth, how the fuck did this happen? it was one little thing we always did was like, how the fuck did this happen? Because it wasn't supposed, you know, this wasn't our goal. We weren't supposed to do this. We were supposed to be experimental. So we've been blessed. I mean, I never thought I'd still be doing this. I'm 61 now. This is like shock. But again, you know, the 20-year-old Andy McCluskey would be horrified. You know, it's a young man's trade, this, you know. Drop dead by the time you're 30 or retire. Get out of the way. Let the new come through. Yeah. So I think, you know, that my 20-year-old self would have been horrified that I'm still doing this. And all I could possibly do is say, sit down, son. Have a listen to the Punishment of Luxury album that exactly. I made when I was 58.
Yeah.
And tell me if you're proud of yourself at the age of 58. And I think I would have gone, shit, this is great. All right, carry on. You're not embarrassing yourself. It's good.
That's fantastic.
We did a live Twitter listening party with Tim Burgess last night, actually. And the number of people who were like, I didn't know you were still making great music. Like, yeah, it's our raison d'être. We're not here for a new logo on the T-shirt next time we tour. We ain't going to release an album unless it's brilliant.
No,
he said modestly.
It's fair. And to say, I've gone back to the more recent stuff you've done, and it is great. You know, you're not resting on your laurels. You're not like, you know, knocking it out for the sake of it. And you can tell it's done with love and passion. And yeah, long may it continue if we get another one in another year or so. It'd be fantastic. The punishment of luxury is in the air for all to see, and it's ugly now. And it's getting worse every day. Hey, hey, hey. Diligence, savoir faire. Can I have my check, please, sir? Because I'm leaving now.
Well, it looks like there will be one. And you know what? You should not be allowed to make a record unless you put love and passion into it. But you know, there's no record police out there. It's, you know, and a lot of people at my age, understandably, you know, they want to sit by the swimming pool drinking Pimm's and you know, enjoy what they got. Fortunately, I don't have a swimming pool and the weather's too cold in the Northwest. So I just go into my programming room and write music.
That sounds great. I'll just tell you a little story though, Andy. So summer of 2018, I've just gone to see Liam Gallagher play at Finsbury Park. And, you know, sort of walking out, leaving Finsbury Park, heading back to the tube station, bit beard up, bit kind of hazy with sunstroke, having been out in a really hot day. And you know, walking away from like a big Oasis gig or a Liam gig, you expect people to be singing Don't Look Back in Anger or, you know, Live Forever or Supersonic or something like that. And the song that's, I'm, wait, is that Atomic Kitten? And everyone's like, looking back on when we first met, was it Southgate? You're the one. You still tell me football's coming home. I'm looking around at my mates like, are people all singing Atomic Kitten? Liam gig? What the hell is going on? So you had this amazing kind of other sort of this break, I suppose, maybe it's kind of become now in the history of your career, where you created these these great pop records for this band Atomic Kitten, which then went away, and then you've come back and done this. But then suddenly, summer of 2018, it becomes the football anthem. It becomes Three Lions of 2018. Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
Well, yeah, the fact that thousands of people are singing Atomic Kitten song at a Liam gig, my work is done now. I can't give up, retire. That's it. My job is complete. Listen, you know, I need to say something to you, actually, because a lot of Oasis fans, and I know that Liam in particular, think that, you know, I hate Oasis, and I did an interview at Synth Pop Britannia when what I was saying was I didn't understand that we'd entered this postmodern era. And I was saying to you, you know, we were trying to be the future. So how come things that sound like the past are now the future? And that documentary finishes with me standing outside at Eric's going, you know, and then, you know, guitars are back in fashion and you get Oasis, horror. Mm. And a lot of people have taken that as being like, oh, really? Oh, so you hate Oasis, do you? I'm like, no, they are great songwriters. I don't know the guys. I never met them. One of our guys who one of our crew guys actually does keyboard and guitar tech for them, actually. He used to be in our band when we were kids. And in fact, when we did Jules Holland, he was there and he said, oh yeah, Liam's not very happy because he's in the same room as you after what you said on that. I said, tell him it wasn't about, you know, they took a clip of me explaining why I couldn't get my head around postmodern, and something that we tried to kill as being old fashioned had come back into fashion. We didn't understand it. That's what I was trying to say. He said, no, mate, you ain't going to listen to me telling him that. I said, well, you'll just have to carry on hating me then, won't he?
Yeah, probably not best not to try and reason with Liam Gallagher in that way. But you know what? From the you know, the myriad of people that I've spoken to that know him, if you just did bump into him backstage or something, he'd probably be really cool with you. I think that, like, he's, especially now, he's sort of calmed down a lot. So yeah, maybe you'll meet him at the back of Jonathan Ross or something in a couple of years and have a drink together.
We'll bury the hatchet and not in each other's heads. Yeah.
Although that is always a possibility. You never know. All right. Well, Andy, thank you so much for taking the time. I just wanted to finish off by saying, from this 1001 albums, do you think, number one, that this album deserves to be in there? And number two, what other of your albums do you think deserve to be in there, either instead of or as well as this one?
You're inviting me to be completely egotistical and narcissistic, aren't you?
Absolutely. So Jinder from Corner Shop basically said all of his albums should be in there. So yeah, please carry on.
Well, one of the things that we wanted to do with Tim Burgess is to call to attention the fact that we think that our last studio album, Punishment to Luxury, is one of the best three we've ever done. And so since everybody talks about Architecture, Morality and Dazzle Ships, I would say about Dazzle Ships and Punishment of Luxury, I think. But, you know, it doesn't matter. As I say, I don't really care about these lists. You know, we know what we did. We're proud of most of it. The stuff that wasn't quite as good as it should have been was because we were put under pressure to deliver and because we had no money. Because this is the thing. We had massive hits, but we signed such a crap deal when we were kids that we got no money. You know, we went round and round America trying to break America, spending money because we were losing money being a support band. Right. And so all the record royalties that we were getting paid were appalling. I mean, this isn't a sob story, but this is just trying to explain, you know, why some of our thinking didn't turn out to be that good, because it's like, you know, we get back from a world tour and a manager go, you're skint and you can't pay me or the rest of the band or the crew unless you get an advance for the next album. So deliver it tomorrow. that was the reality. We go, hang on, we've just sold how many millions? How come we owe the record company £1 million? Because you're on a shit royalty. Because you signed a deal when you were 19 that you didn't care about because you didn't think you were going to be pop stars and nobody would buy your records. Now repent at your leisure.
Yeah. Because every single other band were desperate for any sort of a chance to get off and do this. And so, yeah, you would. All these awful stories about, you know, bands that didn't, you know, that weren't just ripped off, but were actually imploded and, you know, never even released anything because they just got fleeced by managers and accountants and things. Mm-hmm. It is so many stories of that throughout rock and roll. But
I mean, the greatest sad story of all time for me is the story of the guys who wrote the song Without You. Yeah, the guys in a band called Badfinger wrote it.
Oh, okay.
And to be honest, their version isn't that good. But Harry Nilsson heard it and said, I want to do a cover version of that. And sold bazillions and bazillions of records and songs and everything. And obviously the PRS and the publishing would have been massive for the guys who wrote it. Unfortunately, they were so skint that a year or two before, they had sold the entire publishing rights to their album to their manager for something like 250 quid, lock, stock, and barrel. He had licensed it to the publishers. And so the publishers and the manager got all the money, and the two guys got not one single penny, and they both committed suicide.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know the Badfinger guys, you know, did commit suicide. I didn't know that part about the Without You, actually.
Well, I can't forget tomorrow when I think of all my sorrow. I had you there, then I let you go. And now it's only fair that I should let you know what you should know.
Yeah, they were so skint, they sold the rights to everything just to get a few hundred quid to feed their families. And then, you know, it was... that was the one thing you know, that I remember, one thing I learned about the music industry was, at some point I said to my accountant, you know, but it's just not fair. And he looked at me and went, how have you been in the industry? It's not fair at all. You sign a contract saying, I want to make a record and I'm prepared to let you fuck me this hard up the arse. That's basically, there's nothing fair about that. It's just a deal.
Yeah.
And that there you go. That's the last thing I'll say to you.
Well, that is, what on that bombshell, as they say. But Andy McCluskey, thank you so much for your time today. And any,
thanks, James.
Where can the kids find you online if they want to look you up, or OMD?
We have OMD, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You'll find them all just by typing in OMD and the relevant connections. And it's good. You know, I quite enjoy the opportunity of having social media connections, because, you know, we can, you're talking about, you know, how strongly connected to us many of our fans are. We can sell out gigs and tours just by dropping it on our internet sites, and that's it, bang. The tickets go out in a day. So I'm really blessed, you know. Never in a million years would I have wanted to still be doing this 40 odd years later, but I'm quite happy with what we're doing, because I think we're still doing it for the right reasons and enjoying it. So hopefully we'll get back to something resembling normality soon, and see where we go from there. And it would be lovely to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time to do the research and really thinking about the songs. And I like to hear some of the things that you got from them that you've derived that were not intentionally in there. But that's great, because as long as you got something from it, then it worked.
Well, I wasn't going to lie to you and say, oh, I'm a massive OMD fan, I know all your stuff inside out, because then you could say, okay, what was the fourth track on Dazzle Ships? I'll be, you know, so so no, I just wanted to be honest. But no, as I say, I've had a great time. I've been, you know, just immersed myself in the world of OMD for the last sort of few couple of weeks, and it's been magic. It's been great. And anyone listening, I suggest they do the same.
Well, good. I'm glad that we've confounded your expectations, whatever they were. we're still doing the job we set out to do. All right, James. Take care. Thank you,
thanks,
sir.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.